This is Audible.
Blackstone Publishing presents The Practicing Stoic by Ward Farnsworth. This book is read by John Lesko. Preface. This is a book about human nature and its management. The wisest students of that subject in ancient times, and perhaps of all time, were known as the Stoics. Their recommendations about how to think and live do not resemble the grim lack of feeling we associate with the word Stoic in English today. The original Stoics were philosophers and psychologists of the most ingenious kind, and also highly practical. They offered solutions to the problems of everyday life, and advice about how to overcome our irrationalities that are still relevant and helpful now. The chapters that follow explain the most useful of their teachings in 12 lessons. That was a brief statement of the book's purpose. The reader who finds it enough can proceed to chapter 1. For those wanting a fuller account of the rationale for what follows, here is a more complete statement. 1. The body of ideas known as Stoicism contains some of the finest and most durable wisdom of any age. The Stoics were deep students of desire, fear, status, emotion, and much else that bedeviled the human race thousands of years ago, and bedevils it still. They were philosophers of a down-to-earth sort, seeking by force of their insights to free ordinary people from their sufferings and illusions. The Stoics had their limitations, of course. They held some beliefs that very few people do anymore. But in other ways, they were far ahead of their times. They said a number of the best things that anyone ever has. The teachings of the Stoics are as interesting and valuable now as when first written, maybe more so, since the passage of 2 millennia has confirmed so much of what they said. The idiocies, miseries, and other discouragements of our era tend to seem novel or modern. Hearing them described in a classical dialogue reminds us that they are nothing new. This itself was a claim of the Stoics, that the stories and problems of humanity don't change, but just put on new masks. The same can be said for the remedies. The most productive advice anyone offers nowadays, casually or in a bestseller, often amounts to a restatement or rediscovery of something the Stoics said with more economy, intelligence, and wit long ago. The reader does better by going straight to the sages. 2. The Stoicism in this book is a set of ideas developed by philosophers in ancient Greece and Rome. To repeat what was mentioned at the outset, for it cannot be said enough, Stoicism did not mean for them what the word now means to us. Stoicism usually refers in current English to suffering without complaint. Our subject is something else and more. Philosophical Stoics don't do much complaining, but for them that is a small point. A Stoic would probably be glad to complain if it helped anything. Stoic also is sometimes thought to mean grim, which is likewise inaccurate. A Stoic is more likely to be distinguished by mild humor in the face of things regarded as grim by others. Or some imagine that Stoics seek to remove themselves from the world, that it is a philosophy of retreat into oneself. Again, the opposite is true. Stoics are supposed to involve themselves in public affairs. The result of all this confusion is a minor nuisance for the student of our subject. Most people don't know what Stoicism is, but they don't know that they don't know. Stoicism got its name because Zeno of Sicium, circa 334 to circa 262 BC, the founder of the school, did his teaching in a public colonnade or porch, stoa, overlooking the Agora of Athens. Stoicism was known on this account as the philosophy of the porch, as opposed to the philosophy of the garden, that of Epicurus, or the philosophy of the Academy, that of Plato, or the philosophy of the Lyceum, that of Aristotle, with each name referring to the place where the teachings of the school were imparted. So if Stoicism sounds too forbidding because of the word's popular meaning, you could try telling your family that you are studying the philosophy of the porch. They might like that. More probably, readers who take an interest in our subject will also have to get used to explaining that when they refer to Stoicism, They mean the old kind. 3. Many books about the Stoics have been written already. I should say a word about why another one seemed worthwhile, and what this book does that others don't. Stoicism has come to us largely through the works of three philosophers who lived in the first 2 centuries A.D., Seneca, Epictetus, and Marcus Aurelius. Seneca and Marcus Aurelius were Romans. Epictetus was Greek, but he, too, lived and taught for part of his life in Rome. The works they left behind tend to be miscellaneous in character. Often they consist of notes written without much order, or sorted in ways no longer meaningful to most readers. Nor are their writings cross-referenced. As a result, what any one of the Stoics taught about a given subject, let alone what they all said, cannot easily be found in one place. Seneca's comments on a topic might be spread over 3 letters and an essay. The same issue might be addressed at the start and end of the discourses attributed to Epictetus, or at a few different places in the journals of Marcus Aurelius. This arrangement can have its advantages. Sometimes unsystematic is better. But it is inconvenient for the student of Stoic thought who wants to see it as a whole, or to gain a sense of one writer's views, or the views of all of them on a particular topic. This book is a response to the state of affairs just set forth. It has 3 main features. First, it seeks to organize the ideas of the Stoics in a logical manner that might be described as progressive. Foundational principles come first, then their applications. I've tried to put the applications into a sequence that builds naturally, and, where relevant, that follows their growth in complexity. This approach is roughly reflected in the order of the chapters, in the order of the headings within each chapter, and in the order of the discussions under each heading. Those who don't care about the progression can roam around at random. The chapters are self-contained, so you don't need to read one to understand the next. But having a framework may still make the relationships between different parts of the philosophy easier to see. Second, the book aims to draw together the most important points that the different Stoics made about each subject and each division of it. Sometimes they spoke to different aspects of an issue. Seneca addresses one part of it, Epictetus takes another. In other cases, the same topic was discussed by all the Stoics. In that event, it is interesting to compare what they said and how they said it. The format lets them talk to each other. Third, this book mostly presents the teachings of the Stoics in their own words, or more precisely, in the translated words of the writers who stated them best. The introduction that comes after this preface, and then the introductions to each chapter, provide summaries for those who want them. And the first chapter contains more exposition than the others, because it is the beginning. But the reader can skip all this with no harm done. Those who prefer restatements of Stoicism have other books to read, including some fine recent entries. The goal of this one is to concisely present what the Stoics themselves said. There is a distinct pleasure to be had, for those with a taste for it, in receiving these lessons from their original sources. An observation about our world that seems sharp and accurate gains a different kind of force when we see it expressed 20 centuries ago. The truth improves with age. 4. Carving up long works into excerpts, as is done here, necessarily means a sacrifice of context. Isolated sentences from a letter that Seneca sent to Lucilius can't capture the larger purpose for which his point was offered, for example, let alone the full thrust of the letter or the place of it in the series that Seneca wrote. Nuances inevitably are lost. More generally, selecting and editing and arranging the words of different writers can't help but affect the way the reader takes their meaning. The same is true of the book's organization. It presents Stoicism under a series of headings meant to be intuitive, for us. It is not the organization that any of the Greeks or Romans would have used. In any event, none did. In short, the choices this book makes about what to include and in what order amount to an interpretation of Stoicism. That will be plain enough to anyone familiar with the primary sources. I emphasize the point for the sake of those who are not. My hope is that readers who like what follows and haven't yet read the originals will do that next. 5. This book means to offer a short course on Stoicism taught principally by the Stoics. In the living version of the class that I now and again imagine, though, we might have guest speakers as well. Montaigne, for instance, would make a lively visitor. So we also will hear from him and some others who might be regarded as intellectual descendants of the Stoics, because they were strongly and visibly influenced by them. The descendants typically depart from Stoicism on certain matters of theory, but agree on points more germane to this book. They give memorable expression to Stoic tenets and offer variations on them. Sometimes they pilfer them outright. Their writings are instructive to read for their own sake, and because they let us see Stoicism as a tradition of thought that has lived beyond its classical origins. We sometimes will hear as well from Greek and Roman writers who were not Stoics themselves, but agreed with them in ways that will interest us. It is usually the same story. Philosophers of nearby schools dispute the answers to questions about the purpose of life, or the nature of the universe, or comparably large matters. But they have some of the same views on more immediate questions, such as how to think about money, or fame, or hardship, or death. They converge as they descend. In sum, this book treats Epictetus, Seneca, and Marcus Aurelius as canonical sources. If they said it, I've been prepared to include it here, and to regard it as a Stoic teaching, whether or not it follows from anything the Greeks are thought to have said earlier. More on this in a moment. And once a proposition is so identified, the book will frequently pause to show how other writers, cousins or descendants of the Stoics, have expressed the same point, or illustrated it, or elaborated on it. The book preserves some redundancies in the writings of the Stoics and eliminates others. If different writers are shown to have said similar things, it is because their agreement is of interest. If one writer is shown to have made the same point in different ways, it is because each restatement offers a detail of possible value to the student of the idea. But those who find that they have had enough of a theme can move on to the next without penalty. 6. Stoicism originated in ancient Greece. This book, nevertheless, gives little attention to the early Greek Stoics. It might seem unjust, as well as unfortunate, to leave out Zeno, Cleanthes, Chrysippus, and other charter members of the school, while including the later writers just mentioned. The difficulty is that only fragments from the Greeks have survived. While there are texts from Galen, Cicero, Plutarch, and others that talk about what the early Stoics said, we have no extended works in which they speak for themselves. The second-hand accounts we do have are enough to allow scholars to piece together many of the earliest Stoic ideas, but the results don't fit well in a book of this type. The approach this book takes instead, in which the late Stoics are treated as canonical, is open to objection. Stoicism might better be defined by the oldest and most consistent precepts of the philosophy that we can make out, rather than by the views of writers who came later, and who have sometimes been accused of heterodoxy. In the late Stoic writings, we do find some departures from what the Greeks seem to have said, or tension with it, or digressions from it. Not everything a Stoic says is Stoicism on this view, and some of the entries in this book shouldn't have qualified for inclusion because they don't hew closely enough to the core principles of the philosophy. My view is that the late Stoicism of the Romans deserves its own attention and credit. It was not as theoretically subtle and original as what the Greeks developed, no doubt, but it has other strengths. The late Stoics were more than popularizers of what the earlier ones said. They were innovators in adapting it to ordinary life. Granted, we don't have much of what the Greeks wrote, or all that the Romans did. But what we do know suggests that the late edition of the philosophy was a more pragmatic enterprise than the early one, as Roman undertakings are apt to seem when set next to Greek examples of the same. The late Stoic writings thus hold up as a separate body of work with its own advantages and choices of emphasis, and can be read with profit and without apology for however it might differ from the Greek variety. The most important example of this point should be stated directly. I include some positions of Seneca's and call them Stoic, that some would say are departures from Stoicism. Seneca's views on certain subjects, especially involving emotion, are, in my judgment, more helpful and convincing than those of other Stoics. Readers who like what he had to say should not have to be described as Senecaists or some comparable deformity. Seneca was the most prolific Stoic writer whose work has survived. I think it makes best sense to treat his teachings, even where they occasionally departed from those of the Greeks, as a version of Stoicism rather than a mix of fidelity and lapses from it. If the result must be named distinctly, let it be called Reform Stoicism, or some such thing. 7. Stoicism covered many topics, so a comment is in order about which ones are discussed here and which are left out. This book is, first, about ethics. In casual, current usage, ethics usually means rules about what behavior is right and wrong, particularly in how we treat other people. For philosophical purposes, though, the term also refers to larger questions about how to act and the meaning of the good life. Much of what follows belongs under that heading, though some of what the Stoics thought about ethics, including much of their theoretical apparatus, is not included. The subject of the book can also be described as psychology, a topic we regard as separate from philosophy, but that the Stoics did not distinguish from it. Most chapters take as their topic some aspect of human irrationality and how it might be tamed. These inquiries of the Stoics will appeal to some readers for the same reasons they find modern cognitive psychology appealing. Understanding our own minds helps us become conscious of our misjudgments, a little more perceptive, a little more self-aware, a little less stupid. In some respects, cognitive psychologists, too, can be counted as successors of the Stoic philosophers. And the Stoics anticipated a number of their findings, as we shall see. But the Stoics, while less rigorous in their methods, are more ambitious in the questions that they try to answer. They propose a way of life. The Stoicism of this book, then, amounts to a blend of philosophy and psychology, and is weighted toward the latter. It is so weighted because the Stoics, from where we now sit, are at times more enduring psychologists than philosophers. Some of the philosophical claims they regarded as most important, about what it means to live according to nature, for example, and why it matters, have not aged well. Their observations of how our thinking betrays us have more often stood the test of time. There admittedly can be a loss as well as a gain from this choice of emphasis. Some Stoic teachings might appear incomplete or unsatisfying, unless they are joined to first principles of ethics or metaphysics of a kind largely avoided here. But I expect that readers will bring along their own first principles regardless, and will find the counsels of the Stoics compatible with a wide range of them. Stoicism originally included much besides ethics and psychology. The ancients would have identified logic and physics as additional headings. Within physics, they would put theories that we might assign to cosmology and theology, including some that, as just noted, have few subscribers left. The Stoics believed that reason infuses the universe. They saw nature as intelligent, and events as expressing the will of a benevolent providence. This book does not present any of those doctrines, or show how the ideas discussed here relate to them. They would require a volume much longer than this, and meanwhile, most readers today don't believe in Stoic theology, and don't need it to learn from what else the Stoics said. Such is the argument of this book, that the writings of the Stoics have retained vitality, not because their beliefs about the cosmos still have resonance, but because their insights about human nature do. I do not mean to suggest that the Stoics have nothing worthwhile to say about the largest problems of life. On the contrary, Stoicism is rewarding in part because it addresses some of the same questions about how to live that many religions do, and sometimes reaches similar conclusions. But it gets there by observation and reason alone. Or rather, it can. The Stoics did have a theology, as I've said. But you may remove that pillar and the temple still stands. Their analysis and advice hold up well enough without it. To put the point differently, the Stoics, when speaking in the manner shown here, will sometimes be found to arrive at the same summit as the followers of other philosophical or spiritual traditions, but they go up the mountain by a different face. Their way will be congenial to many modern readers. It is the path of logic, reflection, and knowledge of humanity. 8. The title of this book is open to more than one reading. The discussion just offered will suggest the intent behind it. I regard a practicing Stoic as someone who tries to remember the wisdom of the Stoics when dealing with life and thinking about thinking. One attracted to Stoicism not as a creed or theology, but as valuable counsel and as a form of psychological hygiene. This book, in other words, is for those more interested in the practice of Stoicism than the theory of it. Of course, I do not begrudge any others their love of the high theory of Stoicism, and they are entitled to books too, but they already have them. The title also means to suggest humility. A practicing Stoic can be considered one who was trying to learn what the Stoics had to teach and not doing it well enough to yet claim success. The book is not The Proficient Stoic or The Complete Stoic, but merely The Practicing Stoic, which is no doubt the most that anyone should say. Are you a Stoic? No, just practicing. 9. Stoicism has been subject to many criticisms over the years, and a reader of this book should know something about them. My interest here is not so much in the technical critiques of Stoicism made by academics or rival philosophers, many of which I would concede or leave to the specialists. I'm more interested in knocks the Stoics have taken in literary conversation because those assessments strike closer to the teachings that are the subject of this book. Chapter 13 shows three of the most standard of those criticisms and makes comments on them. It is healthy for those getting to know the Stoics to see what people who don't like them have said and to consider what might be said back. I will offer here my general view that many critics of Stoicism treat it uncharitably. They seize on the most extreme things the Stoics said, but don't account for ways in which those points were offset or qualified elsewhere. Or they judge the whole philosophy by its least appealing adherents or features or moments. That's too bad. Not because it is unfair to the Stoics, they don't care, but because it distracts from all that they said that was better. But the criticisms still stick. Many of those who have a view about Stoicism base it on what they have heard, and what they have heard is calumny. Or they associate Stoicism with some single idea that seemed memorable when they heard it, probably because it was jarring. If you study the subject and talk about it with others who haven't, you quickly will see for yourself. Opinions about Stoicism outrun knowledge of it by 100 to 1. The critic might reply that I make an opposite sort of mistake, displaying the more attractive parts of Stoicism and giving short shrift to the rest. That may be true. I have tried to fairly introduce, in a modest space, the applied ethics and psychology of the late Stoics. But if there are more and less reasonable versions of a teaching available, the book goes with the more reasonable one. I've sought to take the Stoics at their best and to present them that way, not for the sake of persuading anyone to think well of Stoicism, but for the sake of producing a useful book. 10. The concessions in the last few comments invite a specialist's criticism that I wish, finally, to anticipate. That this book isn't about Stoic philosophy after all. That what it contains isn't Stoicism or philosophy. It isn't Stoicism because it leaves out too much that the Stoics thought necessary. It isn't philosophy because it leaves out too much that is foundational. Maybe it's good advice, but then it's just advice. Distinctions of this kind may be boring to lay readers, but they mean something to academic scholars, and as an academic, I sympathize. In view of this project's purpose, though, they are of little consequence. I have attempted to create a book for those interested in what the Stoics had to say of lasting value about the challenges of being human. If leaving out deeper precepts, or including ideas that stray from them, makes the result something other than Stoicism, or other than philosophy, our subject can just be described as the practical teachings of those once known as the Stoics. I waive claims to anything more. Nobody should care much anyway about being called a Stoic or not a Stoic. There are no membership benefits that I am aware of. If we want to read our authors in the spirit in which they wrote, we do best to focus on the questions that they thought were of higher priority. They weren't principally seeking to raise the status of a philosophical school or decide who was entitled to join. They were trying to help people see more clearly, live more wisely, and bear the burdens of their lives with greater ease. Let us see how they did. Dramatis Personae. Getting acquainted with the Stoic teachers for oneself is a distinct pleasure of the study of our subject. For the benefit of those not already familiar with them, here are short introductions to the writers who will appear most often in the pages to come. 1. Major figures. 3 Stoic writers dominate this book. On some topics, all of them comment. On others, one specializes more than the rest. A. Seneca the Younger, Lucius Annaeus Seneca, lived from about 4 BC to 65 AD. He was born in Spain. His father, who had the same name, and so was remembered as Seneca the Elder, was a teacher of rhetoric. The son, our Seneca, was taken to Rome when he was young. After a period spent in Egypt, an early career as a lawyer and politician, and a banishment to Corsica, he became a tutor and advisor to Nero, an emperor of odious reputation. Seneca also became very wealthy. Seneca was accused in 65 AD of joining the Piconian conspiracy, which had unsuccessfully plotted the murder of Nero. He was ordered by the emperor to commit suicide, which he did. He cut open his veins and sat in a hot bath, though they say it was the steam that finally did him in. The episode is the subject of a fine allusion in The Godfather Part II. Seneca wrote letters, dialogues, and essays on philosophy, and also a number of plays. His writings are the most substantial surviving body of work on Stoicism, and the largest source of material for this book. His wealth and political life have sometimes caused him to be condemned as a hypocrite, whose life was inconsistent with his teachings. This issue is discussed in a brief essay in Chapter 13. B. Epictetus lived from approximately 55 to 135 AD. He was born in the region we now know as Turkey and spent most of the first half of his life in Rome. On that account, I sometimes refer to him as one of the Roman Stoics. When philosophers were banished by the Emperor Domitian, Epictetus moved to Greece and established a school there. Epictetus left behind no writings. The words attributed to him are the notes of Arrian, a famous student in his school. From Arrian we have works known as the Discourses of Epictetus, as well as the Enchiridion, or Handbook, Arrian wrote in Greek. We also have some fragments of less certain authenticity preserved by Stobaeus, circa 500 AD. When you read Epictetus, it is best to imagine that you are seeing a rough transcript of what he said in class. Epictetus led a life very different from those of our other principal writers. He had a crippled leg, he was born a slave, and his later liberation gave him a curious connection to Seneca. As noted a moment ago, Seneca was accused of joining a conspiracy to murder Nero. The conspiracy was revealed in part by Epaphroditus, a secretary to the emperor. Epaphroditus was the owner of Epictetus, and may have been responsible for freeing him, though this and much else in the life of Epictetus involves some conjecture. Epaphroditus was later put to death for failing to prevent Nero's own suicide. It was an age of hardball. Epictetus studied in Rome under Musonius Rufus, another Stoic who left behind no writings of his own, but later we will see a couple of fragments from him too. Musonius Rufus is probably best known now for teaching that women are as suitable for philosophical training as men. C. Marcus Aurelius. In full, Marcus Aurelius Antoninus Augustus, 121 to 180 AD. In 138, the Emperor Hadrian selected his own successor, Antoninus Pius, by adopting him. Hadrian also arranged for Antoninus to adopt Marcus Aurelius, who was then a teenager. Antoninus Pius ascended to the throne soon thereafter, and was emperor for more than 20 years. Upon his death in 160, Marcus Aurelius became emperor, and reigned for nearly 20 years more, for the first 8 years in partnership with his adoptive brother, Lucius Verus, and during the last few years in partnership with his son, Commodus, of whom the less said the better. For a stretch of time in the middle, Marcus Aurelius was emperor by himself, an improbable moment in which the most powerful person in the world may have been the wisest. Mostly while on military campaigns during the last decade of his life, Marcus Aurelius wrote philosophical notes to himself in Greek that we call his Meditations. He never described himself as a Stoic in his writings, but he was a devoted student of the philosophy, and has long been treated as one of its defining authors. As is apparent from these notes, our Roman Stoics lived overlapping lives, but just barely. The first died when the second was young, and the second died when the third was young. So far as we know, none of them had any contact with each other. Marcus Aurelius does thank one of his Stoic teachers, Junius Rusticus, for giving him a copy of the Discourses of Epictetus, and he occasionally quotes from that work. 2. Supporting classical characters. A few other classical writers, not quite Stoics, but friends or cousins of them, will appear less regularly. A. Epicurus lived from 341 to 270 BC. He is associated, of course, with a philosophy of his own, Epicureanism. By reputation, Epicureanism and Stoicism are opposites. The first is said to be a philosophy of sensual enjoyment and indulgence, the second a philosophy of austerity. Both reputations are misleading. The English word Epicurean nowadays gives an impression of Epicurus about as inaccurate as the word Stoicism does of the Stoics. The two schools of thought do differ in many significant ways, most prominently in the relationships they propose between virtue and happiness. Epicurus regarded pleasure as the only rational motive for mankind, whereas the Stoics thought that our sole rightful purpose is to act virtuously, to live by reason and to help others, from which happiness follows assuredly but incidentally. Despite these differences, however, the Epicurean and the Stoic agree on some important points in their analysis of judgment, desire, and other subjects. Like many other Hellenistic philosophers, Epicurus produced books and essays that have not survived, but we do have a small set of his writings, mostly a few letters and some sets of quotations. One of the larger sets was found in a manuscript in the Vatican Library during the 19th century, the so-called Vatican Sayings. Epicurus is also quoted here and there in the writings of other classical authors. Indeed, a number of the entries from Epicurus in this book were preserved by Seneca himself, who saw it as no cause for embarrassment. Seneca, Epistles 12:11. I shall continue to heap quotations from Epicurus upon you, so that all persons who swear by the words of another, and put a value upon the speaker and not upon the thing spoken, may understand that the best ideas are common property. This book will take the same liberty. B. Cicero. Marcus Tullius Cicero lived from 106 BC to 43 BC. He was one of the leading statesmen and philosophers of Rome, and the most eloquent of its orators. His life was spent largely in political activity as a lawyer, quaestor, praetor, and consul. After the assassination of Julius Caesar, he advocated the rescue of Rome as a republic. When Mark Antony secured his place as one of the dictators of the Second Triumvirate, he ordered Cicero to be executed and mounted his head and hands in the Forum. Cicero turned to philosophical writing in the last phase of his life, though much of his aim and achievement was to preserve Greek philosophical learning. He also made contributions of his own. His philosophical books were, until recent times, among the most widely read and influential of all ancient works. The extent to which Cicero can be considered a Stoic has been subject to debate. He shared some of their positions and rejected others. But he agreed with the Stoics on many points of ethics and described Stoic principles in ways that sometimes are helpful to see. C. Plutarch. Lucius Mestrius Plutarchus, circa 45 to 120 AD, was a prolific biographer and philosopher, and the author most notably of Parallel Lives and his essays collected as Moralia. He was born in Greece and lived most of his life there, though at some point he became a citizen of Rome. He also was a priest at the Temple of Apollo at Delphi for his last 25 years. In his philosophical writings, he followed Plato and made many direct criticisms of the Stoics. He probably would not have wanted to appear in a book about them, though his feud seems mostly to have been with the earlier Greeks and to have involved claims not at issue here. At any rate, his ethics sometimes overlapped with those found in late Stoicism, as we will see. 3. Supporting modern characters. This book sometimes offers passages from more recent writers who, as explained earlier, might be regarded as descendants of the Stoics. They can't be called Stoics themselves because they parted company on too many questions, but they all read the Stoic philosophers and all expressed Stoic views on some of the topics in this book. A. Montaigne, Michel Echem de Montaigne, 1533-1592, was a French lawyer, statesman, and philosopher. His essays, written over a 22-year period after he mostly withdrew from public life, popularized that format as a kind of literature. Their topics are wide-ranging and often personal. He provides a more extensive discussion of certain Stoic principles, and sometimes a more felicitous statement of them, than is found anywhere else. Montaigne was raised to speak Latin as his first language, and he retained a lifelong love of classical learning. At one point, he was referred to as the French Seneca, and he openly acknowledged the debts he owed to Seneca and to Plutarch. Montaigne of Books, 1580. When I transplant the reasoning and ideas of others into my own soil and mix them with mine, I deliberately conceal the names of the authors. I do this to rein in the temerity of those hasty criticisms thrown at every kind of writing, especially contemporary writings by living authors, and writings that use common language, language that invites anyone to be a critic, and that can make the conception and design of the book seem just as common. I want them to tweak Plutarch on my nose, and to burn themselves by insulting the Seneca in me. The truth of this assessment will be seen in the pages ahead. Montaigne also presents some challenges for our purposes because he was an endless fount of ideas, many of which were not Stoic. He was a skeptic, and so could not subscribe to the more theoretical claims the Stoics made, and some of his views changed over time. I will treat 1580 as the date of publication of his essays, but he wrote and revised them over two decades, so I have generally proceeded as explained earlier, by asking first whether a given claim is found in the ancient Stoic sources. If so, restatement or elaboration of it by Montaigne will sometimes be provided. B. Samuel Johnson, 1709-1784, was an English essayist, poet, critic, and producer of various other sorts of writings. He was the author of the most celebrated and amusing of all English dictionaries, and subject of the most celebrated and amusing of all English biographies, Boswell's Life of Johnson. Though Johnson has occasionally been described as a Stoic, that label is best avoided. It is not a fit to his writings as a whole, some of which disparage Stoicism. In Johnson's writings on ethics, though, he agrees with the Stoics often, and gives excellent form to many of their ideas. Johnson often wrote in a style that now seems grandiloquent. He liked to use fancy words. This makes his prose hard for most people now to enjoy in long stretches, but our doses of it will be modest. C. Adam Smith, 1723-1790, was a Scottish philosopher and economist who was a close reader of the Stoics and much influenced by them. Though his own philosophy departed from Stoicism in many ways, he critiques it in detail in The Theory of Moral Sentiments, but agreed with the Stoics on some particulars. Smith was a contemporary of Samuel Johnson's and a professor of James Boswell's at Glasgow University, but it is not clear whether they met. A well-circulated anecdote describes Smith and Johnson as encountering each other for their first and only time at a party in Scotland and briefly exchanging insults, but it has been challenged, alas, as a fabrication. D. Arthur Schopenhauer, 1788-1860, was a pessimistic German philosopher and essayist. He wrote about a large range of topics, many of them far from the concerns of this book, but touched on a number of our themes in essays he wrote late in his life. He too did not accept Stoicism in full. He made criticisms of it, and did not believe happiness could be achieved through reason. But as with all the others mentioned here, he read the Stoics carefully and had much in common with them on subsidiary points. He is good to have around in a book like this, because his interpretations of Stoic ideas have a different and more modern intellectual flavor than that of our other writers. There will be appearances by some other writers as well, including Guillaume de Vere, a French contemporary of Montaigne's. He attempted explicitly to reconcile Stoicism with Christianity, a movement sometimes known as Neo-Stoicism. His interpretations are of occasional interest, as are those of various others who appear too infrequently in the book to introduce here. As this book is meant for a general audience, I have not used endnotes. When explanatory comments have seemed worth including, they appear directly in the text. They consist mostly of brief notes on ancient characters who are referenced by the Stoics or their friends. Part of the fun of our topic is the chance to touch and learn a bit about the classical world, inexhaustibly a fascinating ancestor of our own. Translations. This book contains many passages not originally written in English. Translations of all the original texts exist in the public domain. When those versions were found suitable for our purposes, I have not hesitated to use them. This book is especially indebted to many venerable translations in the Loeb Classical Library, and the translations of Schopenhauer done by T. Bailey Saunders. In most cases, however, the translations have been revised or redone entirely to bring them into a clearer, modern English that remains faithful to the originals. I wish to thank Michael Gagarin, Carl Galinsky, Andrew Cull, and Ashley Vokes, magnificent colleagues, all of them, for their talent and generosity in helping with that aspect of the project. There is at times some sexism in how the Stoics express themselves that I have not expunged, as my aim has been to show what they said as accurately as can be managed. I hope the reader will look past that issue. While the political thinking of the Stoics is mostly beyond our scope, they were notable for welcoming women to the practice of their philosophy, and favoring equality for them in other ways as well, sometimes to a degree that was radical for their times. For comments on the manuscript, my thanks to the colleagues mentioned above, and to Anya Bidwell, Chelsea Bingham, Daniel Cantor, Robert Chesney, Alexandra Delp, Anne Farnsworth, Janet Farnsworth, Sam Farnsworth, David Greenwald, Aaron Gregg, Harris Kerr, Lucy Lyford, Brian Perez Daple, Reed Powers, William Powers, Jan Ratzio, Christopher Roberts, Ted Skillman, and Brendan Walsh. Responsibility for errors is mine. I also wish to thank Carl W. Scarborough, the best in the business, for designing the inside of the book and the cover. Introduction. This introduction provides a brief and rough summary of the ideas that follow in the rest of the book. None of this is necessary. It is just a convenience for the reader who likes to have an overview. 1. We appear to go through life reacting directly to events and all else in the world. That appearance is an illusion. We react to our judgments and opinions, to our thoughts about things, not to things themselves. We usually aren't aware of this. Events come to us through lenses of judgment that are so familiar we forget we have them on. Stoics seek to become conscious of those judgments, to find the irrationality in them, and to choose them more carefully. This idea is foundational to Stoicism. Sometimes its truth can be seen by noticing that when we react to an event, we really are reacting to what we've said to ourselves about it. Perhaps we can say something different. But in other cases, it's harder to see the role of judgments in producing a reaction because they are so ingrained that we take them for granted. The Stoics investigate those reactions, the ones that feel inevitable, by comparing them to the very different reactions that others have to the same things when their conditioning is different, or to the different reactions that we have when our circumstances are different. The Stoics infer from all this that our way of reacting to anything depends indeed on thoughts we think and beliefs we hold, however deeply buried they might be. Since those beliefs and thoughts belong to us, they should be possible to change, and so ought to be subject to more rational scrutiny than they usually get. Our experience of the world is our own doing, not the world's doing, and the Stoic means to take responsibility for it. Chapter 1. 2. We should stake our well-being on what we can control and let go of attachment to what we cannot. We generally can't control events or the opinions or behavior of others or whatever else is outside ourselves. The Stoic thus considers money, fame, misfortunes, and the like to be externals and regards them with detachment. A Stoic still has preferences about those things, and so would prefer to avoid adversity and would rather have wealth than not have it. But attachment to those desires or fears is considered a guarantee of anxiety and a form of enslavement to whoever controls the objects of them. In sum, it is against Stoic policy to worry about things you can't control. What we can control and should care about are our own judgments and actions. Chapter 2. To put these first two points together, we get attached to things beyond our control, and this brings us misery. We are oblivious to features of our thinking that we can control, and that, if managed better, would bring us peace. Stoicism tries to make us conscious of this pattern and reverse it. 3. Having shown that our thoughts and judgments create our experience, the Stoics set out to change them. They use two kinds of strategies for the purpose, which we might describe as analytical and intuitive. The analytical side consists of rational arguments, using reason and evidence to show the futility of material desires, the needlessness of various fears, and so on. The intuitive approach consists of looking at life from perspectives that are meant to have effects similar to those produced by the arguments, but without the arguments. One just sees things from a new angle and has a different reaction to them. Equivalently, we might say the Stoics seek to persuade with words and with pictures. To begin with the intuitive side, that is, the pictures, we all have an ordinary and automatic point of view. We peer out from inside ourselves and see the world accordingly. This angle of observation makes us captive to a long list of deceptions. The Stoic seeks freedom from them by looking at events from a standpoint less obvious, comparing things or events to the scale of the world or of time, or seeing them as they would look from far away, or seeing your own actions through the eyes of an onlooker, or regarding what happens to yourself as you would if it happened to someone else. Stoics gain skill at viewing life from perspectives that encourage humility and virtue, and that dissolve the misjudgments we live by. Chapter 3 and elsewhere. The Stoic also works not only to overcome the fear of death, but to treat mortality as another source of perspective and inspiration. Being mindful that existence has an end puts daily life into a new and ennobling light, in much the same way as contemplation of the scale of the universe or of time. Chapter 4. Stoics also practice thinking about comparisons that make us less neurotic than the envious ones with which we ordinarily harass ourselves. Chapter 5. These all could be considered more examples of seeking wisdom through adjustment of one's point of view. 4. Turning to the analytical side of the project, the Stoics dissect the stuff of our inner lives, desires, fears, emotions, vanities, and the rest. Those states are shown to be products of how we think and to mostly amount to mistakes. The judgments that lie behind them are found on inspection to be false or idiotic. The Stoic remedies broadly amount to applications of the first two points above. We react not to things, but to our judgments about them, and those judgments typically consist of scripts that follow convention or are otherwise foolish or fictitious. The Stoics try to dismantle the scripts and give us better ways to talk to ourselves about the subjects of them. The more specific Stoic analysis of desire, fear, and perception consumes the middle of the book, and it can't all be summarized here. Much of it involves observing human nature very exactly and taking notes on the irrationality found in it. For example, we desire whatever we don't have. We are contemptuous of whatever we do have, and we judge our state and our success by comparisons that are arbitrary and pointless. We chase money and pleasure in ways that can bring no real satisfaction. We pursue reputation in the eyes of others that can do us no real good. We torment ourselves with fear of things that are more easily endured than worried about. We constantly overlook the present moment because we are preoccupied with future states that will in turn be overlooked when they arrive. There is more, but this suggests the flavor of the Stoic diagnosis. In short, we vex ourselves with beliefs, mostly half-conscious, that came from nowhere we can name, and that tend to make us unhappy and ridiculous. Thinking better and harder about the workings of our minds can free us from many subtle insanities. It might seem doubtful that analysis of the kind just sketched could change the way one feels about anything. You might suppose that people can't be talked out of habits and feelings that they weren't talked into, but sometimes they can. Besides, the point of Stoicism is that without realizing it, we often were talked into our feelings by our culture and by ourselves. Chapters 5 through 9. 5. Stoics take a different view of adversity than is conventional. They don't seek out pain or hardship, but they seek a mindset that isn't thrown into disarray by those things, and that is able to turn them to good. It is an unavoidable and important part of life to meet with what we don't want, and unwanted developments produce great achievements, strong characters, and other things we do want. Stoicism, therefore, means applying one's imagination to developments that seem unwelcome, and using them as a kind of building material. The Stoic takes whatever happens and puts it to use. Chapter 10. 6. Some of the Stoic analysis just reviewed has a rich but negative character. It amounts to the reasoned annihilation of false beliefs that serve us badly. As a Stoic sees it, though, none of this should lead to despair. Quite the contrary. We can find more durable and satisfying pleasures in wisdom and less anguish than we ever did in our illusions. The Stoics propose an escape to reality, so to speak, not away from it. Seeing the world clearly, understanding life rightly, and being free from the fictions that drive most people crazy. This they regard as the good life. Chapters 6 and 11. Stoics also advocate enjoyment of pleasures that are natural, as opposed to the ones we invent to keep ourselves going on the hamster wheel. The usual Stoic goal is to enjoy or react or do most else in the world with moderation and a sense of detachment. Chapter 6. The detachment doesn't mean a lack of attention or interest. It is better considered an aspect of moderation. Moderation, that is, in our relationships to external things. Stoics avoid getting elated or crushed or otherwise worked up about them. A large share of Stoicism might be viewed, in effect, as an interpretation of two famous inscriptions above the entrance to the Temple of Apollo at Delphi. Know thyself, nothing in excess. The Stoics turn those maxims into a detailed philosophical practice. 7. Stoicism also offers a strong affirmative vision of what life is for, the pursuit of virtue. Living virtuously means living by reason, and the Stoics regard reason as calling for honesty, kindness, humility, and devotion to the greater good. It also calls for involvement in public affairs, that is, in the work of helping others, in whatever ways are available. Instead of living to satisfy desires, Stoics regard themselves as meant to function as parts of a whole. There is great joy to be had in this, though it is not the variety that comes from the acquisition of things or approval from others. The happiness the Stoic seeks is eudaimonia, the good life, or well-being. Virtues bring about that type of happiness as a byproduct, and Stoics regard this as the only reliable path by which happiness can be secured. Chapter 11. 8. Stoicism is meant to be a practice, not a set of claims to admire. It is hard work, because many of our judgments, and the fears and desires that follow from them, are habitual, and hard to change or set aside, and they are constantly reinforced by our surroundings and conventions. Taming the mind through reason takes the same kind of commitment that we associate with martial arts or other demanding physical disciplines. In return, Stoicism offers happiness, equanimity, and sanity. Chapter 12. 9. Stoicism has been criticized for advocating a lack of feeling or compassion, for asking the impossible of its students, and, because it is impossible, for making hypocrites out of those who claim to follow it. Chapter 13 offers some replies to those criticisms. To summarize, A. Stoics can be viewed as using reason as a substitute for time and experience. They try to respond to temptations and hardships and about the way they might if they were experiencing them for the thousandth time. The recommended Stoic reaction to most things is the natural reaction of the veteran. This way of looking at Stoicism makes it less otherworldly. The philosophy can be considered an effort to help us toward the state of mind we might reach on our own with more time, rather than as an effort to make us less human. Looking at Stoicism this way also makes clear that the practicing Stoic isn't unfeeling or uncaring. The Stoic responds to the suffering of others like a good doctor who has seen it all before, with activity and compassion, though probably without much emotion. B. Perfect Stoicism is no doubt impossible. The wise man, held up as an example by the Stoics, is best viewed as an ideal. It is meant to provide a direction rather than a destination. This shouldn't be alarming. Many philosophical and religious traditions call on their aspirants to work toward an ideal that nobody quite attains. The question is not whether anyone gets to the end. It is whether we are helped by trying. C. Claims of Stoic hypocrisy usually arise from a misunderstanding of what Stoicism is for. Its purpose is to help those who use it, not to give them a basis for judgment of others. The exhortations of Stoic teachers sometimes create a different impression, but explaining Stoicism and practicing Stoicism are different activities. Stoicism may have to be taught if it is to be learned, but the practice of it involves thinking and acting, not preaching. If Stoicism inspires claims of hypocrisy against its students, the students are probably bad Stoics, not because their actions are impure, but because they are talking too much. The order of the chapters in this book mostly follows the order of the discussion above. Many discussions of Stoicism start instead with the definition and place of virtue in the philosophy. In this book, that comes later. Not because it is less important than what comes earlier, but because it is, I suggest, easier to follow once one understands the Stoic view of what reason means and requires, which is a theme developed in the earlier chapters. I say this so the reader will feel free to take what follows in whatever order is of interest, and not treat the sequence of topics as an argument of the Stoics or as an argument of mine. The order is proposed as useful, not at all as essential. Chapter 1. Judgment. The first principle of practical Stoicism is this. We don't react to events. We react to our judgments about them. And the judgments are up to us. We will see the Stoics develop that idea in the pages to come. But this expression of it is typical. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations, 8:47. If any external thing causes you distress, it is not the thing itself that troubles you, but your own judgment about it. And this you have the power to eliminate now. The Stoic claim, in other words, is that our pleasures, griefs, desires, and fears all involve three stages rather than two, not just an event and a reaction, but an event, then a judgment or opinion about it, and then a reaction to the judgment or opinion. Our task is to notice the middle step, to understand its frequent irrationality, and to control it through the patient use of reason. This chapter starts with the noticing. Later chapters will talk about the irrationality and offer advice about control. We begin here because the point is foundational. Most of the rest of what the Stoics say depends on it. Soon we will hear from them about externals, desires, virtues, and much else. But it all begins with the idea that we construct our experience of the world through our beliefs, opinions, and thinking about it. In a word, through our judgments, and that they are up to us. For many students of Stoic philosophy, this first principle starts as counterintuitive, gradually becomes convincing, and finally seems obviously true. And then the cycle may be repeated, because the mind constantly gives us an opposite impression that appears convincing in its own right. Our reactions to whatever happens usually feel direct and spontaneous. They don't seem to involve judgment at all, or at least no judgment that could ever be otherwise. The Stoics consider all this an illusion. The work of dispelling it is hard, because the mind is an unreliable narrator of where our reactions come from. It tells us that we respond to externals, to things out there, not to the mind itself. It has to learn to see and describe its own role more accurately. Stoicism means to help us think better about our thinking, to teach the mind to understand the mind, to make the fish more aware of the water. The truth of the Stoic claim is easiest to see when we react to an offense given strictly to the mind. Suppose someone insults you. The insult is meaningless apart from what you make of it. If you are bothered, it must be because you care. A judgment. Instead, you could decide not to care, and that would be the end of the insult for you. All irritations can be viewed the same way. The noisy neighbor, the bad weather, the traffic jam. If you are riled up by these things, you are riled up by the judgments you make about them, that they are bad, that they are important, that one should get riled up about them. The events don't force you to think any of this. Only you can do it. The same then goes for bigger setbacks, and for desires, fears, and all the rest of our mental events. We always feel as though we react to things in the world. In fact, we react to things in ourselves. And sometimes changing ourselves will be more effective and sensible than trying to change the world. When we feel physical pain or pleasure, the role of the mind in forming our reaction is harder to see. Pains and pleasures seem like immovable facts that owe nothing to our thinking. But even then, the Stoics insist that our judgments about those feelings produce our experience of them. Yes, pain is pain, a sensation that exists no matter what we think about it. But how much bother it causes, how much attention we pay to it, what it means to us, these are judgments, and all ours to determine. Pains and pleasures are made bigger or smaller by the way we talk to ourselves about them, or by judgments that are too deep to articulate, but are nevertheless our own. We underrate the power of these judgments because we barely notice them. Stoics notice them. For more discussion of pain in particular, see Chapter 10, Section 11. The idea that our reactions depend on our judgments can seem especially strange if judgments are all imagined to be conscious and rational. But a judgment can take many forms. You conclude that spiders aren't dangerous, yet still are afraid of them. Does this show that your fear is separate from any opinion you hold about spiders? No, it just means you have conflicting judgments, that spiders are safe and that they aren't. The second will take time to uproot, even after you decide it's wrong. Put differently, some judgments are just things we say to ourselves, and those are the easier ones to fix. Others are ingrained and nonverbal. The Stoics will sometimes include, under judgments, everything that we bring to the world when we meet it. The appetite that we have or don't have that makes a plate of food look better or worse, or a lifetime of conditioning that produces the same effect. These may not be easy to change. Here, then, is another reason why Stoicism is hard and why nobody gets to perfection. Some reactions may belong to us and yet not quite be up to us. Or they are up to us in theory, but we don't have the psychological strength to change them. More broadly, the Stoics didn't distinguish in their thinking, as we now might, between all the forms that our judgments can take: conscious opinions, unconscious attitudes, conditioned responses, chemical predispositions, genetic tendencies, and so on. And how some of those can be changed more easily than others. They do make a few such acknowledgments. The Stoics say that some reactions have a physical basis we can't control. See Chapter 9, Section 1. And Seneca concedes that we are born with some temperamental features that can't be changed. See Chapter 10, Section 10. But our ordinary reactions to things, our reactions at rest, are viewed mostly just as ours to control with practice. Anyone can see how difficult this idea would be to carry out in full. Just think of your own strongest likes and dislikes, and how hard it would be to reverse them with any amount of thinking. But fortunately, and importantly, Stoicism doesn't care what our tastes are, and doesn't call for reversal of our aversions and desires. it calls for detachment from them. That isn't easy either, but it is far more often feasible. We may consider it the Stoic goal, in any event, to become conscious of our judgments and take control of them as far as we can. One's ability to do this may be limited in ways that we now understand better than the ancients did. A psychiatric patient would not be well served by a helping of Epictetus alone. But even after making allowances of that kind, the Stoics would say that our ability to change our experience by changing our thinking about it is much greater than we usually suppose. Many of the judgments they urge us to notice and to reconsider aren't so deeply rooted. They're just habits and conventions. The Stoics don't expect these claims to be taken on faith. They support them with arguments. Sometimes they use easy examples, such as the insults already discussed, things that anyone can see are a big deal only if we decide they are. For reactions that more stubbornly seem to be inevitable, though, the Stoics often use comparisons to make their point. They look at the different ways that people react to the same events in different circumstances, times, and places. What some people fear and can't imagine not fearing, others don't. What some are ready to die for, to others is nothing. The pain or grief that seems a brute fact to us is experienced very differently in other conditions and cultures. Evidently, our reactions aren't inevitable after all.